Tim E. Less. Tim isn't a perfect man. He's not the perfect husband or father. He's a man struggling to provide for his family. No matter how hard he tries, it's all falling apart. When it looks like things can't get any worse, the accident happens. Tim can't remember a thing, only the sound of twisting metal, of the nightmares, and of coyotes stalking him through the halls of Stillwater Sanitarium. Followed Tim on his downward spiral through the asylum, through hell and back as he uncovers the truth of what happened to his family. Tim E. Less is a disturbed horror thriller of insanity, chemical seduction, and true nightmares come to life. Lucas Milliron. People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. 709, Robert H. Blake. People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is brought to you by bunnyslippers.com and founditemclothing.com. Hey, Australia, New Zealand, or anywhere that is Chile right now. Keep your feet warm and cute this winter with some Cthulhu slippers from bunnyslippers.com. And get your favorite screen-accurate shirts from your favorite films from founditemclothing.com.
Woohoo. Mm-hmm. Written and edited by Daniel Spitzer. Audio by Sarah Fee and Daniel Spitzer. Music by Kevin MacLeod. PGTTCM is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Learn more at darkmyths.org. Welcome to the People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos.
We are engaged in an ongoing discussion of the Cthulhu Mythos and its timeline regarding Earth. To be a part of it, contact us at pgttcm@gmail.com or join us on Facebook or Twitter, or just search for PGTTCM.
And remember to rate, review, and subscribe to PGTTCM on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yay.
Click our patron button on pgttcm.podbean.com for early release episodes, unique audio content, or otherwise unreleased banter. Contact us about our sticker cult, or donate a few dollars to paypal.me/pgttcm.
Greetings, listeners. It is we, D.B. Spitzer and Sarah Fee, here to talk to you once again about the Cthulhu mythos, its books, its monsters, its unfortunate human casualties, its timeline in general, and even its tangential bits like the Dreamlands, or things of a weird nature, or things that are Lovecraftian leaning. From the creation of our galaxy to the death of our sun, this is an exploration of the Cthulhu mythos from the perspective of humanity's concept of history. Learn of terrible meetings in lonely places, of cyclopean ruins in which vast staircases lead down to abysses of nighted secrets, of complex angles that lead through invisible walls to other regions of space and time, and of hideous explorations in remote and forbidden places, on other worlds, and in different space-time continua.
Check the show's merch table at pgttcm.threadless.com. You can find lots of cool shirts and mugs and stuff like that. All original designs by D.B. Spitzer, or check out the store link at pgttcm.com.
Remember to check out the books that we review on amazon.com, and why not use our Amazon link and look for the Strange Behaviors anthology by Nihilism Revisited, and look for the micro story by D.B. Spitzer.
The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos starts now! All right. Hey, so the other day we saw that movie.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, Solo.
Yeah, oh gosh, yes, uh-huh. It was, it's a little fuzzy for me now, but it was fun.
Yeah, it was fun. I enjoyed it. And there's a rad robot in there, like in Rogue One.
Yeah.
A bunch of characters that you're like, oh, wow, I'd like to see them in other movies. Oh, never mind.
Because they're all dead.
They're all dead. Yeah. Not everyone dies. Some people show up in other movies.
No, but I mean, this one guy and the Wookiee survive.
Yeah.
Surprise. And they're on their way to Tatooine.
Oh, yeah. No.
Stars in their eyes, hope in their hearts.
Oh, gee.
Also, in this movie, Han did shoot first.
Oh, yeah.
Woo-hoo-hoo.
Of course he shot first.
Of course he did.
And also, Chewbacca ate a bunch of people at some point.
What?
Because he was the monster in the pit.
Well, but,
and they've been feeding him prisoners. Oh, we haven't fed him in a few days.
Well, I mean, the thing is like, it's implied that they expect him to eat Han Solo. But my guess is that they haven't been feeding him people. They just hadn't fed him in a couple of days, and now he's going to rip Han Solo apart because he's starving.
I like to think that Chewbacca would have eaten Han Solo if Han Solo didn't know a handful of Wookiee.
Hmm, interesting theory.
Yeah.
I know a handful of Wookiee.
I don't.
I don't either, actually. Don't trust my Wookiee. I probably just called somebody's mother something.
Yeah. He saw that Han Solo movie. I have to say, this is a good movie. People should go see it. I know, like, the week that Han Solo came out, you spent, like, $40 at the theater seeing Deadpool 2 and didn't feel like going to the theater the next week. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you just were like, oh, The Last Jedi kind of sucked. I don't feel like going to a Star Wars. This is a Star Wars, I think, that's worth seeing. I mean, it doesn't make up for, like, for me, what kind of that's like, oh, that The Last Jedi was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know not everyone feels the same way I do, but I was just kind of like, oh.
Everybody has their own taste in movies.
Oh, certainly. Certainly. All right.
Yeah.
So today we'll be talking about Robert H. Blake.
Hey, that's not bold.
I know.
That's my line.
I'm just telling you where we're at.
Okay, want me to start then?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm reading again now. We're done with banter.
Apparently.
Okay, today we'll be talking about Robert H. Blake, a fictional character created by H.P. Lovecraft, ever hear of the guy, and based on friend writer Robert Block. Robert Blake is a young author and painter from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He comes to Providence, Rhode Island, and moves into an apartment on College Street. While there, he completes 5 short stories, The Burrower Beneath, The Feaster from the Stars, The Veil of Panath, Shagai, and The Stairs in the Crypt. He becomes obsessed with the deserted church on Federal Hill that he can see from his window. He later learns of a cult that was once active there, the Church of Starry Wisdom. His investigation of this cult inevitably leads to his death. Lovecraft based Robert Blake on one of his correspondents, the teenage Robert Block, who had just begun his career as a writer of horror and science fiction. In the story, Lovecraft even had Blake residing at Block's real-life address at the time, 620 East Knapp Street, Milwaukee. The development of the Blake character has a notable backstory. The character first appeared as the unnamed narrator of Block's The Shambler from the Stars, 1935. Before he wrote the tale, Block thought it would be amusing to kill off a character based on Lovecraft. Lovecraft consented to the idea and gave his permission in the form of a satirical letter signed by Lovecraft himself and attested by several of his creations, Abdul al-Hazrad, Gaspard de Nord, Frederick von Hunst, and the Chocho Lama of Lang, possibly referring to the high priest not to be described. The body of the letter appears as follows.
This here certifies that Robert Block Esquire of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, USA, reincarnation of Mynheer Ludwig Prynne, author of De Vermis Mysteries, is fully authorized to betray, murder, annihilate, disintegrate, transfigure, metamorphose, or otherwise manhandle the undersigned in the tale of The Shambler from the Stars.
In Block's story, the Lovecraft-based character becomes the ill-fated victim of an invisible vampiric monster summoned from the depths of outer space. Lovecraft was delighted by the story and returned the favor by killing off Robert Block, a.k.a. Robert Blake, in The Haunter of the Dark. Years later, Block wrote a sequel to The Haunter of the Dark entitled The Shadow from the Steeple, 1950, in which Robert Blake's death is investigated by his friend Edmund Fisk.
In a rear vestry room beside the apse, Blake found a rotting desk and a ceiling-high shelves of mildewed, disintegrating books. Here, for the first time, he received a positive shock of object horror, for the titles of those books told him much. They were the black, forbidden things which most sane people have never even heard of, or have only in furtive, timorous whispers, the banned and dreaded repositories of equivocal secrets and immemorial formula, which have trickled down the stream of time from the days of man's youth and the dim, fabulous days before man was. He had himself read many of them, the Latin version of the abhorred Necronomicon, the sinister Liber Ivanus, the infamous Cult des Ghouls of Comte Erlant, the Unsprechen Kulten von Juntz, and Ludwig Prinz's hellish Divermis Mysteries. But there were others he had known merely by reputation or not at all, like the Narcotic Manuscripts, the Book of Zahn, and the crumbling volume in wholly unidentifiable characters, yet which certain symbols and diagrams shudderingly recognizable to the occult student. Clearly, the lingering local rumors had not lied. This place had once been the seat of an evil older than mankind and wider than the known universe.
In Providence, Rhode Island, Robert Blake, a young writer with an interest in the occult, becomes fascinated by a large, disused church on Federal Hill, which he can see from his lodgings in the city's Upper East Side. His researchers reveal that the church has a sinister history involving a cult called the Church of Starry Wisdom, and is dreaded by the local migrant inhabitants as being haunted by a primeval evil. Blake enters the church and ascends the tower, where he discovers the skeleton of Edwin M. Lillibridge, a reporter who disappeared in 1893. Blake also discovers an ancient stone artifact known as the Shining Trapezohedron, which has the property of being able to summon a terrible being from the depths of time and space. The trapezohedron rests in a metal box with a hinged lid. The box is incised with designs representing living but distinctly alien creatures. The whole sits atop a column, which is also incised with alien designs or characters. Blake's interference inadvertently summons the malign being of the title, and he leaves the church aware that he has caused some mischief.
As Blake grew accustomed to the feeble light, he noticed odd bas-reliefs on the strange open box of yellowish metal. Approaching, he tried to clear the dust away with his hands and handkerchief, and saw that the figures were of a monstrous and utterly alien kind, depicting entities which, though seemingly alive, represented no known life form ever evolved on this planet. The 4-inch seeming sphere turned out to be a nearly black, red-stained polyhedron with many irregular flat surfaces, either a very remarkable crystal of, or an artificial object of, carved and highly polished mineral matter. It did not touch the bottom of the box, but was held suspended by means of a metal band around its center, and 7 queerly designed supports extending horizontally to angles of the box's inner wall near the top. This stone, once exposed, exerted upon Blake an almost alarming fascination. He could scarcely tear his eyes away from it, and as he looked at its glistening surfaces, he almost fancied it was transparent and half-formed worlds of wonders within. In his mind floated pictures of alien orbs and great stone towers and other orbs with Titan mountains and no mark of life, and still remoter spaces where only a stirring of vague blackishness told the presence of consciousness and will.
The being can only go abroad in darkness, and is hence constrained to the tower at night by the presence of the lights of the city. However, when the city electric power is weakened during a thunderstorm, the local people are terrified by the sounds coming from the church and call on their Catholic priests to lead prayers against the demon. Blake, aware of what he has let loose, is also terrified and prays for the power to remain on. However, a power outage occurs and the being flies towards Blake's quarters. He is subsequently found dead, staring out of his window at the church with a look of horror on his face. His last words refer to his perception of the approaching being.
I see it, coming here. Hell wind, Titan, Blur, Black Wings, Yogg, Sotha, save me. The three-lobed burning eye.
Ooh. Yeah, the Haunter of the Dark.
Yeah.
Robert H. Blake.
Anyway.
Anyway. But yeah, no, this was written by H.P. Lovecraft, as we said, November 1935, and got published in December 36, Weird Tales, Volume 28, Number 5.
Cool.
Yeah. This is an interesting story. It references a lot of different various other tales from the Cthulhu mythos. It mentions Yoggoth from Whisper in Darkness. Mm-hmm. It mentions the crinoid things of Antarctica, mm-hmm. The elder things from the Mountains of Madness.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Serpent Men of Volusia from Robert E. Howard tales. Nephrim Ka.
Like the bookshelf itself is like a call out, you know?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
But the catacombs of Nephrim Ka are mentioned in The Outsider. And yeah, no, I mean, it's...
I thought this whole stuff with the Catholic priests was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So like, one of the things in the story is that the church has been closed for 50 years, which is part of why there's a skeleton in there that nobody's found.
Yeah.
And then later on, the skeleton is missing, which implies that maybe somebody is caretaking after he goes out. Maybe somebody else went in. I don't know. Anyway, so because Robert Blake keeps waking up in the tower, like he keeps sleepwalking to it in this story. So the Catholic priests are interesting to me because there was an Irish priest who succeeded in driving out the Starry Wisdom cult, basically, shutting them down. And then somehow more Italians keep coming in, and it's like, oh, are Italians, quote, more degenerate, unquote, than Irish people? Is this what's going on here?
I'm not quite sure what he's trying to say with
because
that.
The, like, Italian priest is still, like, you know, keeping up the prayers and the candle vigils and all that, but he's not as effective. So I wonder what's, you know, what, like... part of the heterogeneous diaspora he's trying to, like, you know, malign here.
Yeah, no, I'm not quite sure what he's trying to say or what he was trying to say. I think I kind of got the impression what he was trying to say is, like, the newer church isn't quite as powerful as the older Catholic Church. Like, the older ways.
But why would okay, but
you know, kind of like okay, like in The Exorcist, like the young priest doesn't know shit about exorcism. The old guy knows.
That's a good point. Stuff. And the Italian priest is his new priest because he's young. Yeah.
So I mean, I don't think it was kind of like
Italian versus Irish.
I don't think it was anything like that. I think it was more of H.P. Lovecraft's concept of, like, the older world is more powerful than the new world, and the new world wouldn't know what happened if.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
If a fly bit it.
Exactly.
All right, interesting. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is an example of Lovecraft's, like, racism being different than it is normally.
It's a good point, yeah. I also really liked the description of the old-timey electric grid.
Yeah.
That was really interesting to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, this is very much kind of a very modern story. That's the thing about Lovecraft is he wrote in the modern age. He wrote about the astronomy that was going on. He wrote about, like, the infrastructure. I mean, it's pretty cool stuff. I mean, he was down on the rurals and whatnot.
Well, and like, one of the things, of course, is that 50 years ago when the Starry Wisdom cult was shut down when this story was written in 1935, there was no more than 50 years. Anyway, the point is that there was no electric grid around the church. So I guess maybe they must have unsummoned or banished the lurker, the
fiend haunter.
The haunter in the darkness. The multi-limbed acidic creature that makes you smoke and die of horror.
Yep.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Do you go on?
Yeah. Love the description of the inside of the church, personally. That was, like, one thing that I have always remembered about this story was the description of the inside of the church. And also how this has always felt like a Call of Cthulhu scenario. Like, I feel like this is a prime example of, like, what Call of Cthulhu role-playing game scenarios are based off of. This is very much an investigation, you know, not a massive, like, world-spanning one, like, you know, Masks of Nyarlathotep, but, you know, mm-hmm. like a small one that you get in the back of, like, Dragon magazine or something like that. Anyway, but, you know, just like a quick story and stuff like that, it's very much, I don't know, there's like, this is a full Lovecraft story. This you know, has like a beginning, a middle, and an end, a first, second, and third act.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no, like, cliffhangers, like, oh, what happens? It's like,
We know what happens. Yeah.
I mean, we don't know what happens afterwards. Robert Bloch wrote another story, the sequel to this, about the investigation of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll talk about that in some other point in time, but not right now.
After season 8, maybe?
Some point in time in the Cthulhu Mythos timeline when we're going to be going more in depth into stuff.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah. So, I think that's pretty much it. I don't have much else to talk about with this.
Yeah.
I mean, Inside the Shining,
Trapezohedron?
Yes. Inside of the Shining, Trapezohedron, the spooky monster that we talk about, the three-lobed-eyed flapping bat thing that lives in the clock tower. Mm-hmm. That's a avatar of Nyarlathotep however you want to say that name.
Mostly on the show, it's Nyarlathotep.
Yep. Yeah. But yeah, no, that's an avatar of the Big N.
Cool.
And
I had no idea.
Yeah. No. Got like 1,000 avatars, so you know it can do a bunch of different things.
A lot of sense.
Yep. But yeah, so, no.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I really liked was the description of the way that this church steeple is haunting him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he sees it. He's like across the city,
yeah.
Right? He sees it from his window. He finds it interesting. There's a whole bunch of church spires he can see. This one is interesting to him, partly because there's no birds. And mm-hmm. then he one day decides to go find it. And he can't really find it. And then all of a sudden, it's right there in front of him.
Yep.
Which I love that description of walking through a city that's got sort of like ill-regulated building heights and what that's like. And then, like once he goes in and awakens the shining tetrahedron and I guess summons a guy, then it won't leave him alone.
Yeah.
It goes through his dreams. He wakes up in it. It's just always present for him.
Yeah.
Which is like why we have those quote last words of his, is because he was writing because he was afraid.
Yeah.
He was writing in the dark, which is a crazy thing to try. I don't know if you've ever done it, but it is crazy to try and write in the dark. It makes it really hard to write.
Yeah. No, I don't try to write in the dark.
Yeah. It was, as a crazy death scene for sure.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. But why didn't he have candles?
I have no idea. Because he was too dependent on
electric lights. Modern devices. If only he'd had an oil lamp.
I know. Okay, here's something I don't get.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so H.P. Lovecraft, totally down with science.
Yeah.
But also, at the same time, kind of dismissive towards modern stuff. But also, and like, kind of like, oh, some of the old traditions are better. But also, like, down on rustics for, like, being like, you know, oh, living out in the woods.
Okay.
Ami.
Well, I mean, like... okay, so like in our modern age, somebody can live out in the middle of the woods and still, like, you know, watch Babylon 5 or whatever.
Sure.
Let's pretend. It's the 90s, but listen, or the early aughts. But listen, so they can be in touch with the same cultural touchstones as you and I.
Yeah.
But back in the early 1900s, if you were out in the middle of nowhere... You couldn't, like, go into the city and watch a play. You didn't get the latest sheet music.
Mm-hmm.
There were no phonograph spindles at your local hardware store. You know, you just weren't in touch with modern culture. Modern culture was passing you by. The gossip of the town was not a part of your everyday life. And sure. So, you know, when somebody came out to talk to you, your touchstones of that big store 2 years ago were, you know, and their touchstone of, like, you know, the five most recent plays and what the political, you know, guys said on their stump speeches are completely different. You don't have the same cultural context. Whereas, uh-huh. like, now with culture being everywhere, we have that. So the idea of rustics isn't the same. And he doesn't, like, think that rustics are, you know, are pitiable or sort of weird because of a lack of use of modern technology, you know, like plumbing and electricity and whatnot. He is that way about them because they're, like, their mental, he talks about, like, their mental capacity being lower, and they're like, but, you know, if you're always doing the same thing all the time and you're doing what your dad did, it's hard. The idea is that their brains aren't getting stretched. They're not reading. They're not
gotcha.
Learning. You know, they're not exposed to libraries, which is why that guy in the Gardner story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is, like, different is, you know, he's like, I found him to be better educated than a run of the mill rustics because he's a reader.
Color out of space.
Exactly. Thank you. The color out of space.
Yeah. No. It seems like there's always, like, the like the stoic rustic, the wise rustic, mm-hmm. in several of these, like, well, out in the woods H.P. Lovecraft stories.
It's the same idea as the noble savage. Yeah. It's like, this one is different. Yeah. This one I this can is talk a good one. To. Yeah. Yeah. It's like the rest of them, whatever. But this one.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a bridge between our peoples, uh-huh. etc. And it's just a way of, like, making a character that the narrator feels like they can listen to.
Yeah.
You know, and then that's why the narrator survived.
Yeah.
You know.
You know what? If, you know, if Blake hadn't have been in the big city,
mm-hmm.
you know, if he'd been in the country with a right? rustic.
If he'd stayed in Milwaukee.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And this episode or this story is really interesting. Like, it talks about, like, the, you know, early... You know, it mentions, like, Rhode Island School of Design, RISD.
Yeah.
And another thing is they mention, like, 66 College, which is now, like, 65 Providence, or I can't remember exactly what mm-hmm. the street is now. But that was, like, H.P. Lovecraft's residence during the time that he wrote this.
What?
And occasionally that particular apartment will go on sale on Craigslist. And everyone in the Lovecraft community, like, passes around, like, the Craigslist ad for H.P. Lovecraft's apartment. And, of course, like, when people are showing the apartment, there's, like, a book of H.P. Lovecraft on the mantle or something like that. Or not the mantle, because it was kind of a crappy apartment.
Right, but
on the table.
Yeah.
That the realtor or the manager set up.
Yeah, you have to have a table.
And it's all, like, very small and just, like, plaster white walls and...
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, he's renting a crappy apartment.
Yeah. Yeah.
For no money.
Yep. Riding the bus, eating beans.
Probably costs a lot more to rent now.
Oh, yeah. No. Especially since he lived there.
Oh, geez.
And yeah. And how close it is to RISD.
Oh, yeah.
And just, like, you know, like, downtown Providence, mm-hmm, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Hey, everyone. This is D.B. Spitzer, and I have just got done reading The Weird, a strange novella by S.C. Burke. This is published by Nihilism Revisited, and it is their fourth book that they've published. In a world draped in perpetual darkness, had things happened. Art abuses. The air is on fire. Everything burns. Bleak crimes create a scene depicting a cerebral murder mystery. An event has taken place. An event so explosive and traumatic that time has staggered to a stop. And the entire population of Earth can feel its lack of existence becoming a reality. A cosmic serial killer haunts with a heavy hand, and an arsonist turns everything touched to flames, including the air. Strange cultists practice pain and perversion in the name of nothing. A rebel youth with a prowess for violence sings sorrows into the ears of society and a woman named Jane Doe lives a double life as a mother and martyr for humanity's lost souls. Somewhere in the middle of it all rests a house, an interdimensional void that fuels the deepest recesses of the mind's fear of function. The weird is more than a strange feeling. It's the terror and dread that inherently consumes the soul. Everybody knows it. We've all felt its presence. It's a haunting of the human condition. No God, no stars, all dead. Experience transgressive experimentalism at its most dangerous. So it begins. And yes, the weird, a strange novella indeed. Snap, flash, hiss, scream. It's something like if the futurists, the Italian futurists, wrote novels. There's a lot of lists. There's a lot of like automatopoeias. There's a lot of like use of bold and italicism. I've talked about S.E. Burke's stuff before, and there's something about it that reminds me of Leaves of Grass with using typography as a storytelling device. And if there's something that S.E. Burke does well, is using typographical elements for a story device, for storytelling. Just like I have an alarm going off. I'm not editing this part out. Anyway, check out Nihilism Revisited, The Weird, a Strange Novella, written by S.E. Burke. You're going to be able to find that on Amazon. I'm trying to find a good part to read, and it's short exhibits. So this is Wonderland. In the box, nothing inside, nothing inside the box. Look inside the box, nothing. But wait, take another look inside the box. There's someone inside the box, something. Creature of the box, open the box, come out. It's somewhere between poetry and a novel, but it is disconnected, but also connected in ways that you won't quite understand right away. So fucking euphoric, it says in bold print as I flip through. Exhibit 2, My Unholy Mountain. There's no table of contents. It's very other. And I highly recommend, this is the weird of weird fiction. This is really good. Track it down.
Anyway, yeah. So I really think that's all we have for, Blake.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Except for, you know, based off Robert Bloch in name. But sounds like the description of him, it sounds like Clark Ashton Smith, but that's me.
Yeah? You think so?
Yeah. And like the titles were like fun, cool throwbacks to H.P. Lovecraft stories and yeah. like weird fiction stories in general. That was kind of fun.
That was
funny.
I like that he's...
In the Vale of Panath was like totally a reference to, what do you call it? Unknown Kadath. Yeah. Anyway.
I also like that he's praying to Yog-Sothoth as he dies.
Yeah.
That's adorable. And sad.
Truth. But you know what's not sad?
What?
BunnySlippers.com and FoundAutumClothing.com and DarkMyths.org.
No, none of those things are sad. They're all wonderful.
They're all really good. Yeah. And, but yeah, no, that's that for 709.
Woohoo!
Yeah. And our next episode should be, let me pull up the schedule.
Don't reveal that we're semi-organized.
Oh my God, I wish we were semi-organized.
Okay, like a quarter organized.
All right. So coming up next... we will have okay, up next we have Under the Pyramids, reading 46.
More about Narlathotep?
More about someone.
Mm.
Under the Pyramids. And then we're going to have a couple readings of The Call of Cthulhu by H.P. Lovecraft. And then it's going to go into like the weekly reading of The Penal Colony by Franz Kafka. Then it will be some more Call of Cthulhu, some M.R. James. And then finally, we're going to have episode 710, Dyers in Lake, and Lurker in the Hobby. Lurker in the Lobby.
Yeah.
Some more M.R. James. And then we're going to be doing episode 711, Free Slushy. No, I'm kidding. it's going to be about Harry Houdini and Tim E. Less. We're going to finally do something about that.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah. And then there's going to be some more M.R. James, Case of Charles Dexter Ward for a while there. And then the last episode of the season, recording-wise, will be Francis Wayland Thurston, and we'll be talking about Nightscape. And then finally, the final reading of Case of Charles Dexter Ward will be in sometime in mid-August.
Yay.
Yeah, and that is season 7 as we see it.
Yeah, don't pause it yet, because I wanted to say something.
Sure.
Okay. I wanted to say that Lurker in the Hobby sounds like the most, like, dangerous craft. It's like, careful. Knitting.
I was going to say.
As you've never seen it before.
Yeah, yeah. No. Madness-inducing book on crocheting.
Oh, my goodness. We talk about needle point of madness, needle point of the starry wisdom cult. Just like, no, don't go there. No Lurker in the Hobby. No.
No. All right. Remember to stay squiggly.
And keep it weird.
All right. Have a good one, everyone.
Woohoo.
Bye.
Bye.